Chapter 3. The sun, distinctly later now, rose over Simmonslea, and penetrating into the lanes, it lit up Ahab, the Woolcombe mule, with George on the double sack that served for a saddle, Harding on the left side with the halter in his hand, and Bridget on the right, trotting along and uttering a very rapid series of observations that tumbled over one another like the babbling of a swallow. George was carrying not only the paper, as was his duty, but also the Woolcombe post-bag, as he explained when they came to the breakfast-room window. "Good morning, Mama," he began beaming through the window. "Good morning, Cousin Diana. Good morning, sir. Good morning, sir. Good morning, sir." To each of those within. "We overtook Bondon and Killick just before Willett's rickyard. The gig had somehow run into Willett's slough, and they were puzzled to get it out. I told them that my Mama would have it on the road in a moment," cried Bridget on tiptoe. "So we've brought the letters too," holding up the bag. "I carried them part of the way, but they happened to drop. Oh, please, may we come in? We're so hungry and cold."
"Certainly not," said Stephen. "Go round to the kitchen and beg Mrs. Pierce to give you a piece of bread and a bowl of milk."
It was usual at Woolcombe to read one's letters at table, and Jack opened the bag with an anxious heart, dreading to see a lawyer's seal or an official mark of any sort. There was nothing of that kind for him or for any of the women, but he did notice the black Admiralty wax on one of the covers he handed to Dundas. "It's just a friendly note from my brother," said Dundas after a moment, "saying that if he'd known I was to stay ashore so long, he would have asked me over for a day or two with the partridges at Fenton, but he dare say that it'll be too late now. The Admiral's sure to summon us the minute Berenice can swim, and you perhaps earlier still. I do wish he'd give me a decent ship. The Berenice is so old and frail she crumples like a paper nautilus. What's the point of having a brother First Lord without he gives you a decent ship?" No one could discover the answer to this. But Sophie said it was a shame, Diana thought downright shabby, and Clarissa, coming in rather late, made a generally sympathising murmur. After a while, Jack said, "So long as the Admiral don't summon me before Friday, when the committee sits, he may do as he damn well pleases, and give me a duck punt for a tender, too." This was an oblique reference to the Bellona's true tender, the Ringle, an American schooner of the kind called a Baltimore Clipper, Jack's private property, much coveted by the Admiral for her fast sailing and her outstanding weatherly qualities. After breakfast, Stephen went to see Bondon in his quarters over the coach house. He was sitting with his hands in a basin, and he explained that he was pickling his fists against Wednesday's fight. "Not that I can ever get them real horny leathery by then," he said, "but it's better than going in raw-handed like a fine lady or a dairy maid, soft with the butter and cream."
"What is your liquor?"
asked Stephen.
"Water, vinegar, very strong tea and spirits of wine, but we put in a little tarbark and dragon's blood as well, and barber's diptych, of course."
"Little do I know of prize-fighting, though I've always had a curiosity to see a right match. But I had supposed that nowadays gloves were used."
"Why, so they are, sir, for light sparring and teaching gentlemen the noble art, as they say. But for a serious boxing match, for a genuine prize fight, it's always the bare maulage. Oh, dear me, yes."
He turned his fists in the basin, quite amused.
"Will you tell me the first principles now?"
"An answer?"
"I mean, just how a prize fight is conducted, the rules, the customs."
"Well, first you have to have two men willing and proper to fight. That's to say, a fairly well-matched pair, and someone to put up a purse for the winner. And then you have to find a right place, meadow or heath, where there's plenty of room and no busybody magistrate likely to come down on you for unlawful assembly or breach of the peace. With all that settled, you either mark out a ring with posts and ropes, or you leave it to the members of the fancy. They link their arms and stand in a circle. I prefer the ring myself, because if you're knocked down or flung down under the feet of the other man's friends,
you may get a very ugly kick, or worse.
Is it a brutal sport, then?
Why, truly, it's not for young ladies. But no gouging, kicking or biting's allowed, nor no hitting beneath the belt or striking a man when he's down. To be sure, that still leaves a good deal of room for rum capers, such as getting your man's head in chancery, as we call it, pinned under your left arm, and hammering away with the other fist till he can neither see nor stand. Another great thing is grappling close and then throwing your man down with a trip and falling whoop onto him as hard as ever you can. Accidentally done a purpose, if you understand me, sir. Oh, and I was forgetting. Another of the capers used to be to catch your man by the hair and batter him something cruel with his head held down, which was reckoned fair. That's why most bruisers are cropped short nowadays, and I shall tie my pigtail up uncommon tight in a bandage, which Killick will make it right fast again after every round.
You wouldn't consider being cropped yourself, I suppose.
I don't like to think of that fellow seizing you by the queue and whirling you about to your destruction.
What?
Cried Bunden, jerking the long, heavy plait on the table. Cut off the best tail in the barky? A 10-year tail that I can sit on without a lie. And then think of that cove in the Bible and his bad luck when he was cropped. Oh, sir.
Well, you must be the judge. But tell me, how does it all begin?
The two men come into the ring with their seconds and bottle holders. The referee introduces them like, gentlemen, this is Joe Bloggs of Wapping, and this here is the Myrtle Bough of Hammersmith. They're to fight for a prize of whatever it is, and may the best man win. Then the friends of each chap whistle and cheer and call out, and sometimes the two shake hands before the referee sends them back to the corners where their seconds sit. Reminds them of the rules and the agreed time between the rounds. Half a minute, usually, though some call for three quarters. Scratches the mark in the middle of the ring and says, come on when I say start the mill, and fight away until one of you can't come up to the scratch before time is called.
I do not quite gather the force of the words time and round. Is the contest set to last for a certain period, for so many glasses, as it were?
Oh, no, sir, it can go on till kingdom come, if both men have the strength and pluck. It only comes to an end when one cannot come up to the scratch after a round, whatever his second may do to revive him, either because he's dead, which sometimes happens, or because he's too stunned and mazed to stand, or because an arm's broken, that happens too, or because he don't choose to be punished any longer.
Pray, let's come back to this concept of a round, which puzzles me yet. Which I must have explained it badly, because it's as simple as kiss my hand. A round is when one man is knocked down or thrown down or flings himself down in missing his blow. I mean, that's the end of the round, and it may have lasted a great while or only a minute. Then they must go back to their corners and come up to the scratch when the timekeeper calls time.
I see. So it is as indefinite as a game of cricket where a truly dogged batsman can tire down the sun. But tell me, what is the usual length of a bout?
Why, sir, if it were another gent as asked,
said Bonden with his singularly winning gap-toothed smile, I should say as long as a piece of marlin. But being it's your honour, I'll answer that three or four rounds, or say a quarter of an hour, is usually enough for young fellas new to the game, fellas with some pluck but with little wind and no science, but with right bruisers, fighting for a handsome prize or from a grudge against the other cove or both, right game bruisers with plenty of bottom, it can last a great while. Even in just Navy fighting, I saw Jack Thorold of the Lion and Will Summers of the Old Repulse knock one another about for 43 rounds in just over an hour. Talking to myself, it took me 68 rounds and an hour and 26 minutes to beat Joe Thwaites for who should be champion of the Mediterranean.
Barry, Bonden, you astonish me. I'd suppose it was a 5 or 10 minute affair like a bout with the small sword.
I does see him a long time, but the London fancy are used to even longer battles. Gully fought the game chicken for 2 hours and 20 minutes. The sixth round alone lasted a quarter of an hour. And Jem Belcher and Dutch Sam went on near as long before their seconds agreed to call it a draw. Both men were still game, but they could barely stand. Neither could see, and their mothers wouldn't have recognised them. "Oh, Papa!" cried Bridget, shrill as a bat in her anguish. "Come quick! Come quick! George is bleeding terribly!" She broke into her still somewhat easier Irish, panting as they ran, and explained that she had only given him a little small push to show how prize-fighters did it, and now he was bleeding like a holy martyr. "Oh, if George should die, the sorrow and woe, the black grief of the world!" "Why, child," said Diana, meeting them, "never be so distressed. You only tapped his claret. It's all over now. I've mopped him up and put his shirt to soak. Always remember, my dear, cold water's the only thing for blood. And he's eating syllabub in the kitchen. If you run very fast, you may get some too. Stephen, my dear, Jack is in a great rage. He's been waiting almost 5 minutes to take you to see the mirror. I was coming to fetch you." "God love you, sweetheart," cried Stephen, kissing her. "They'd forgotten it entirely." On their way out to the great mere, where an osprey had been seen that summer, and where hard winter might bring down the odd great northern diver, they saw Captain Griffiths riding along his former track and peering about. He wheeled his horse on catching sight of them emerging from the bushes. "Damn it all," said Jack, "we should have to speak to that fellow again." "Good morning, Aubrey," said Griffiths, touching his hat to Stephen, who responded. "Have you any news from the squadron?" "Not a word." "That's surprising, with the wind so strong and steady in the southwest, hardly varying a point. You could run up from Ushant in a day. However, I hear there's to be a fight between your coxswain and my head keeper on Wednesday. Shall you be there?" "It depends." "I'm afraid I shall not. I have to go up to town for the committee. Shall you attend?" "Conceivably." "In spite of our majority?" "Well," shaking his head, "but to go back to this match, I take the liveliest interest in it, and I'll back my man for any sum you may wish to name, giving 7-5. "You're very good, sir," said Jack, "but on this occasion I don't choose to bet." "As you please, as you please. I dare say you know best, but," turning his horse again, "faint heart never won fair lady, they say." They were by the mere again on Wednesday on the far side, farther than Dundas cared to walk until the widgeons should start coming in. And as Jack set about repairing a hide on the edge of the reed bed, repairing it so that it should be almost indistinguishable from the other reeds, as Harding had showed him so many years ago, he said, "That fellow was prating about faint hearts the other day. I cannot tell you how faint mine is at present when I consider. One unlucky fall on the part of one single unhappy horse, a postchaise losing a wheel, a friend being out of the way, and my ride to London gets me there after the fair. I do not get there for Friday's committee. I'm keeping very quiet today, so as to ride with a clear mind and a firm, untroubled hand. I've not even been to look at the dripping pan. I've kept perfectly calm. Yet I don't know how it is." He paused for quite a while, and then, in the tone of one quoting an aphorism, he went on, "The heart has its reasons that the kidneys," suggested Stephen. "That the kidneys know not." Jack frowned. "No. Hell and death, that's not it. But anyhow, the heart has its reasons, you understand? It's a singularly complex organ, I'm told. And I'm uneasy about a whole variety of things. Tell me, Stephen, did you think there was anything odd about the way that fella talked?" "It seemed to me that he was a little more obviously false than before. And I was quite struck by his insistence on the steadiness of the wind from the blockading squadron. If I do not mistake, the relations between you and Captain Griffiths hardly warrant his riding out to ask you for news." No, indeed. The barest civilities, that's all. No invitations on either side ever since I came home and said I was dead against their scheme of enclosure and should not sign, but should heartily oppose their petition. Has this affected our Admiral, Lord Stranraer? I mean, as far as you were concerned? I cannot tell. I hardly knew him before the Bellona was sent to join his command, but as I told you, he was perfectly ready to dislike me from the start, as a Tory, as a naval member of Parliament, and as my father's son. And another question, Jack. Does a great deal of money depend upon this scheme? I've not gone into it thoroughly, yet I should say that in time there is. They'd have to spend a very considerable amount in hedging, ditching, draining, and above all, clearing. But some of the common, farmed by men with capital, would make famous wheat and root land. And with canals cut through the wet, low-lying waste, it would be capital pasture in a few years' time. Eventually, I believe the whole operation would pay the promoters hands down. They'd make a great deal. The kind of money that would push men on to extreme measures. I think much more than money's involved. For one thing, there's the very high station of a man with some thousands of acres laid out in fair-sized fields, with hedge and ditch ideal country for hunting, and for shooting too, if you care for that kind of shooting. And above all, country inhabited by a few big tenant farmers anxious about their leases, and by a crowd of respectful villagers who have to do what they're told and accept what they're given or go on the parish. A man in that position is as much of an autocrat as the captain of a man of war without the loneliness, the responsibility, the violence of the enemy and the dangers of the sea. Then again, there is the pleasure of having your own way against opposition. And it is but fair to add that they think, or have been persuaded to think, that it's all for the country's good. From Lord Stranraer's reputation, would you say he was a man whose love of his country, of high station, and incidentally of a considerable addition to his fortune, might induce him to bend the ordinary course of morality so that good might result? I should not assert it. I know very little of him. His reputation in the service is that of a good seaman and a strict disciplinarian, but I don't think he's much liked. He's had little opportunity of showing his courage, yet as far as I know it's never been doubted. Before the recent spring tide of prize money that came to him as a flag officer, you know, Stephen, do you not, that even now, after Mulgrave's reforms, an admiral still pockets a third of his captain's prize money, though he may be sitting in port 1,000 miles away from the battle. So if he has several lucky, active, enterprising frigate captains under his orders, he can very soon grow rich. Iniquitous, iniquitous. Yet you may see it in a different light when you hoist your flag. Jack cast him a haggard look, but went on. Before that, he was by no means well-to-do, and even now he still keeps a very modest table. He considered for a moment. No. From the cut of his not very attractive jib, I should never have said he was a man to do good that evil might come of it. Yet, to tell you the truth, Stephen, the older I get, the less I trust in my own judgment. I've been wrong so often. Stephen said, even I've made errors. Shaking his head dolefully. But Jack's attention was elsewhere. He stood tall and straight, a hand behind one much battered ear. "Do you hear?" he asked. "They're beating in the posts to make the ring in the dripping pan." When Woolcombe's early dinner was over, the men only sat long enough for one single glass of port. Then Jack said to his brother, "Philip, will you make our excuses in the drawing-room?" But before the boy had answered, he went on, "No, damn it, I'll go myself." "Ladies," said he, "I must beg you to forgive us. Stephen and Heneage are grown so prodigious impatient I can no longer restrain them. It's not consonant with my duty as a host to restrain them. They say it would be disrespectful to the noble art not to see the first exchange. And anyhow, the doctor should be there to revive either of the dead. From the way they bolted their food, said Diana, when the door had closed behind him. I wonder that we were allowed to finish our dinner at all. Yet at least we can drink our coffee in peace, said Sophie. But first I must change my gown. If I don't get this wine stain out directly, it'll never go. And then I can darn stocking with a clear conscience. How they do love a mill, said Diana, when she came down again. The Colonel Villiers I stayed with in Ireland when Stephen was away. You remember him when he came over, Clarissa? Certainly I do. Splendid old gentleman, so very kind. So he was, but very frail, too. Yet even so, he and an equally ancient friend from Indian days drove close on 40 miles to see a fight between two well-known bruisers, Ikey Pig and Dumb Burke. They came back as merry as grigs and almost speechless with shouting. 40 miles is a great way, began Sophie. Beg pardon, ma'am, said the cook, a short, thick woman, of much greater importance now that Sophie was her own housekeeper, which the kitchen pump won't fetch, and without water how can I boil the captain's puddings, let alone Master Phillips, who fancies a roly-poly today? Why won't it fetch, Mrs. Pierce? Asked Sophie in alarm. Surely the well cannot possibly be dry yet. Which the pin is broke, said Mrs. Pierce, folding her arms. How did it come to be broken? I never was a teller of tales, ma'am. But perhaps someone has been swinging on the handle, though told it was wicked. Oh, I see, said Sophie. Well, you must get a man to put in another pin. God love you, ma'am, said Mrs. Pierce. There ain't a man left in the house, nor yet in the garden nor the yard. Even poor old Harding's crept off, bunions and all, agog to see this horrible murdering match. Oh, come, it cannot be as bad as all that, cried Sophie. Ma'am, I do assure you it is, or worse. That gamekeeper fella, Black Evans, as they call him, served out our poor Hetty's William so cruel over some paltry rabbits that he's never been the same since. And his wife says he never will be. They say the Beelzebub creature was fit to be matched with Tom Cribb himself, but he was barred for fighting foul and gouging out the other party's eye. Right eye. Henry, the blacksmith's young man, had a turn-up with him. Oh, dear me. Mrs. Pierce had been in the house before Sophie was born. She was a valuable soul, a good cook, but voluble. Voluble. And it was long before Sophie could check the bloody narrative and persuade her to use the dairy pump until the men should come back to replace the broken pin. Very good, ma'am, she said. But pausing with the doorknob in her hand, she added, which I only hope Mr. Bonden ain't brought home senseless on a bloody hurdle like poor Hal. The door closed at last. Sophie picked up her stocking and presently the thread of her discourse. Yes, to be sure, she said, 40 miles is a great way. But when I think of the distance Jack has to go this very night and all tomorrow, oh, how I wish it were over. He'll be in the post-chaise most of the time, said Diana, and although it may not be a featherbed, I abominate a featherbed, by the way. I love to have something really firm under my bottom. Oh, Di, cried Sophie, blushing extremely and throwing an anxious glance at Clarissa, who, to her relief, betrayed no emotion of any kind. Clarissa was a clever needlewoman, intent on her work, and her past was of such a nature that rather free or even licentious words made no impression on her at all. And a man who can sleep aboard a small man-of-war beating into a gale can certainly sleep in a chaise. Anyway, it'll not take anything like as long as that. I remember Captain Bettesworth telling me that when he had the courier carrying dispatches, he anchored at Plymouth on the morning of July the 7th and reached the Admiralty at 11 on the night of the 8th. And Plymouth is nearly 80 miles west of us. Don't grieve about Jack, my dear. On a turnpike road you can do wonders in a post-chaise nowadays. A post-chaise... She paused, for at this moment a chaise and four rolled into the courtyard with a fine clatter of hooves and harness. A tall young man in naval uniform leapt out, a letter in his hand. "My God!" cried Diana. "It's Paddy Callaghan of the tender."
"What tender?"
"Why, Bellona's tender, of course, Booby, the Ringle."
"Oh, Lord!"
said Sophie in a low tone of horror. "And here I am with no cap. And this squalid old yellow dress. Pray keep him in conversation for 5 minutes, and I'll be down looking more or less like a Christian."
"Never mind about that," said Diana.
"I know what he's about. I'll deal with him there in the courtyard." She ran out along the hall, reaching the door before the servant. "Good evening, Mr. Callaghan," she called. "What good wind blows you here?" "And a very good evening to you, ma'am. A fine double-reef sou'wester, so it was," said the young man, his large, simple face, not unlike a ham, beaming up at her as she stood there at the top of the steps. "How delightful to see you, and I trust the doctor is well. But I've brought orders for Captain Aubrey," holding up the packet, "and brought them as swift as a bird. This is the first time I've ever been in a four-horse chaise. Captain Jenkins insisted so that Ringle might just catch her tide. There's precious little time to go. She's waiting at single anchor in West Bay."
"Alas, my poor Mr. Callaghan, Captain Aubrey is away in London on important government business."
She came down the steps and went on, "But if you'll give me the letter, I promise he shall have it as soon as he returns. Forgive me if I seem inhospitable, but I really think you ought to hurry straight back to West Bay so that the tender may rejoin the ship at once without missing this selfsame tide. There's not a moment to lose." The young man, a master's mate, looked confounded, worried, deeply uncertain. She took the packet from his hand, urged him back into the chaise and called, "Take a wide sweep, postillion, and you're out in one. Mr. Callaghan, my best compliments to Captain Jenkins, if you please." She stood on the steps, holding the envelope, as the chaise swung out of the gateway.
"Diana,"
said Sophie from just inside the hall, speaking in a low, shocked voice.
"How could you speak so? You know he's at the Dripping Pan."
"Come into the drawing-room, sweetheart," said Diana. And there, with the door shut behind them, she went on, "The tender came with orders for Jack to rejoin his ship immediately. It would have broken his heart to miss this committee meeting and lose the common."
"But you'll never forgive us for lying."
"No, dear," said Diana. "Now, the first thing we must do is to send a message telling him not to come home, but to go straight on to Wootton and take his chaise from there."
"There's no one to send," said Sophie.
"None of the maids could possibly be sent with that rough crowd. There's a whole tribe of gypsies, and both the Aubrey Arms and the Goat have been weeding barrels of beer out there since early dawn."
"I'll go," said Clarissa. "I don't stand out as much as either of you would do. And when I get to the edge of the crowd, I can call one of our people to go and ask the doctor to come. I shall put on ankle boots and an old tippet."
The others looked at her for a moment.
"Do please take Grim,"
said Sophie at last, anxious and ashamed. "Yes, but he must wear his choke collar," said Diana, who'd seen the stable mastiff discourage a stranger. "I shall put it on to him while you get ready." She spoke with a fairly easy conscience. In this house and this village, Clarissa was seen as a dependent. Her presence at the Dripping Pan would be far less remarked. Her scheme was better than any other, and though Diana wasn't proud of herself, she honoured Clarissa for it. "You'll not be afraid of all those rough men?" asked Sophie when Clarissa came down. "No. As far as I've seen, apart from mere brute strength, they're no more formidable than we are. Less so, indeed, since most have that dog-does-not-bite-bitch rule deeply ingrained. Well, nothing of that kind applies to us." Mere brute strength was Stephen's first impression of the prize fight. The referee, a knowing publican from Bridport and a former pugilist, called the men to the middle of the roped-off square. They were both stripped to close-fitting, knee-length linen drawers and to pumps, and they stood on either side of him, Bondon still tan from his seafaring and slightly taller than the other, his pigtail turned tight about his head. The bandage had been disallowed as too much like a protection. Evans, broader, heavier, his flesh corpse-pale except where it was covered by a great mat of black hair. Neither had had much time to train, but both were in reasonable shape, big, powerful men. The referee named them to cheers from either side, and having spoken the ritual words in a hoarse shout, he dismissed each to his corner, scratched a mark on the green, level turf, retired beyond the ropes, and called, "Now start the mill, gents, and may the best man win." Amid the cheers and counter-cheers of all those assembled, most of the men and boys from at least seven villages and their surrounding farms, the two men came up to the scratch. There was no motion towards shaking hands. They eyed one another intently for a moment, with a few slight feints of head and stance, and at exactly the same moment exchanged a series of heavy blows to head and body, most warded off on either side, and then closed, each trying the other's weight and strength. "This is more like wrestling than anything else," said Stephen. He, Jack, Dundas and Philip were sitting on the rising slope behind Bondon's corner. "See that ill-looking hairy fellow has seized Bondon's arm." "He's trying for a cross buttock," said Jack. He was indeed a deadly throw, but unsuccessfully, for with a sudden twist and heave, Bondon flung Evans forward, flat on his face. "Drop on him! Fall heavy! Kick him in the balls!" bellowed the Woolcombe House supporters on either side of Jack and far up the hill behind him. But Bondon only nodded and smiled and walked back to his corner, where he sat on his bottle holder's knee, Tom Farley, a former shipmate who'd come with Captain Dundas, while his second, Preserved Killick, sponged the blood from his face. An unimportant glancing blow that had nevertheless opened his eyebrow. He was breathing rather quick, but he looked cheerful and composed, and when the umpire called time, he sprang up as lively as his friends could wish, met Evans at the scratch, and instantly struck him over his guard, left and right to forehead and ear, blows that were borne with apparent indifference, though they staggered him and drew a surprising flow of blood. Once again Evans closed, and once again there was a long, obscure struggle for mastery until Bondon, breaking away at last, leapt back and then sprang forward, leading with his left at full stretch, a punch that would have ended the match had it gone home. But surprisingly fast for so heavy a man, Evans shifted 6 inches to the left, and Bondon, slipping on the green grass, came down to hoots of derision from the far side of the dripping pan, where the keeper's friends and Captain Griffith's more subservient tenants sat with the hereditary opponents of Woolcombe, the men who lived in the villages of Holt, Woolcombe Major and Steeple Munsted. It was not until the third, and above all, the fourth and fifth round, that Stephen began to see that much more than mere brute strength was involved, very much more. Both men had been hit and hurt. Their blood was up. Each had taken the other's measure. And although Bondon moved quicker and had more science, Evans' blows, above all his body blows, were heavier by far. At one point they stood toe to toe in the middle of the ring, hammering one another with extraordinary rapidity and force. But he perceived that almost all the blows he could follow were diverted by the guard. Indeed, in spite of the apparent confusion of arms and fists, the whole was not unlike a fencing match, with its almost instant anticipation of attack, recoil, parry, and lightning counter-strokes. He sat there, watching them circle, manoeuvre, come in with a storm of blows, close and strive locked together or break apart for a fresh attack. He watched them, under the clear light of a high, veiled sky, fighting there to the roar of the opposing sides. They might have been in the arena of a small provincial Roman town. And he, too, was as tense as any, as he urged his old friend and shipmate to go in and win, shouting for him in a voice he could barely hear for the huge din on either side. 2 long rounds, close on 10 minutes each, and the next, All ended in a knockdown blow. The first two in Bondon's favour. But neither was a genuine stunner, though Evans's bottle holder had to help him back to his corner after the second. The third came after a confused melee in which Evans closed, tripping Bondon and throwing him backwards, most deliberately falling on him, and, amid a great howl of reprobation, planting his knees where they would do most harm. To the shrieks and yells of "Foul!" the two umpires looked at one another and at the referee, who agreed with one of them that the match should go on, though he shook his head as he said so. Killick and Farley brought Bondon back to his corner, revived him as well as they could, and when time was called he came up to the scratch quite briskly. By this point, both men were much marked. Evans's face and ears were mostly blood, and his left eye was nearly closed. But Bondon, though showing less, had been severely punished during the infighting, and from his attitude and breathing, Stephen thought that two or three ribs might be sprung. Their lack of training told on them too, and as though by tacit agreement, they closed early in the next round, not so much hitting as trying for the cross buttock and the decisive throw, or at least for a certain respite and breathing space. They'd been fighting for 40 minutes now. Stephen, watching them gasp in their corners between rounds, was astonished that they could have lasted so long. And in their untrained state, both were nearly exhausted, while Bondon's knuckles were split to the bone. During this slow, laborious, grunting dance, the blood from his open forehead blurred Bondon's sight, and he let himself be manoeuvred to the far side, almost on the ropes of a neutral corner, where Evans's bulk hid him from the umpires and the referees. Here he felt a sudden change in the tension of the clasping arms, a different grunt, and the wicked knee came furious up between his legs. He shot back before it reached its mark, leaving Evans with dangling hands, and hit him two terrible blows, somewhat short since he was on the ropes, but full in the unguarded face. He felt the teeth go, heard an animal shriek of pain and rage, and he was heaved back against the ropes by a great, hairy, sweating weight. In the brutish grapple, his head was thrust under the top rope, the lashing of his hair parted, and as he forced his way back into the ring to end the fight, Evans seized his pigtail in both hands and with his last remaining strength hurled him against the corner post, himself falling as he did so. In the silence that followed the enormous din, the seconds carried their men away. But whereas Evans's friends could just prop him, staggering, half-conscious, half-blind, to the mark when time was called, Killick and Farley could not. Bondon lay flat on his back, his face to the placid sky, and Stephen, kneeling over him, said, "Do not fear, Jack. There is a concussion, sure, but there's no fracture. The coma may last some hours or even days, but then, with the blessing, you'll have your coxswain again. Killick, now, will you find a hurdle? We must carry him home and put him in the dark." Behind them, fighting had broken out between the Woolcombe men who swore the throw was foul and the now anxious minority of the gamekeeper's friends and their supporters. But Killick and a shepherd had brought the hurdle, and the sad little train walked off towards Woolcombe House, disregarding the battle. "Was it fair at all?" asked Stephen in a low voice when they'd gone a little way.
"Well, just. Just, I believe," said Dundas. "Gentleman Jackson held Mendoza by the hair when he beat him in 97. Surely that's Mrs. Oakes coming along the path with the stable dog."
It was indeed. And a variety of signs, her somewhat hesitant attitude, the improbability of her choice of a walk, and many more scarcely to be defined, awoke all the intelligence agent in Maturin. Profiting from the hurdle-bearer's necessary slowness, he hurried forward. Clarissa had a total confidence in him, and told him exactly what was afoot, taking no more than 10 words to do so. "Will I deal with it?" he asked. She nodded. and he rejoined the party. "Jack," he cried at some distance, "I grieve to say that there has been a sad misunderstanding, and the chaise you're sharing with Mr. Judd has been ordered for Wootton. It stands there at this moment, and he begs you'll join him directly." Jack was not always very quick in taking the point of Stephen's longer, more elaborate and even wholly mythical anecdotes, but he knew his friend intimately well. He could interpret a certain fixity of look better than most men. He had a vague recollection of Mr. Judd as one of the deeper old files of Whitehall, and without hesitation he replied, "Hell and death, I was going once." And to Clarissa, "Thank you so much for coming. Please give my dear love to Sophie and tell her I'm very sorry if the blunder was my fault, as I dare say it was." "I see you a furlong on your way," said Stephen. "No more, because of my patient." In the course of this furlong, he told his news, and Jack cried, "God bless Diana. And Mrs. Oakes, that fine woman. I'm sure Sophie would have thought of it in time. She don't want spirit, no, nor yet bottom. But perhaps not quite quick enough. It had to be taken on the half-volley. Bless them! I wouldn't have missed that committee for the world. And as for the blockade during 3 or 4 days, why, at this stage of the war, my withers are unwrung." A pause. "Yet I do wish to God I were going up without this damned unlucky omen. It really does cast a prodigious damp on a man's spirit. The keeper was dead beat. There wasn't another round in him. And even if he had come up to the mark, Bondon only had to give him a shove to floor him for good." Stephen knew of old that it was useless to call out against the weakness of mere superstition. No sailor he'd ever known, even the most eminent, even a full admiral in all the glory of gold lace, had ever been moved an inch by reason, however eloquent. He therefore came to a halt, said, "Fare thee well, dear Jack, and may all the luck in the world go with thee. I must follow my patient." "You don't fear for him, Stephen?" asked Jack, looking earnestly into his face. "I do not. God bless, no. One last thing. Do you suppose they meant to nobble me?" "That's an expression I don't know." "Of course not, I beg pardon. It's a cant word I first heard when I was breeding horses at Ashgrove. The riff-raff hanging about racing stables and Newmarket and so on use it to mean interfering with a horse so he don't run well, and you can safely bet on him losing. There was a nobbler called Dawson hanged for it not long since. What I should have said was, do you think Griffiths and his uncle, our commanding officer, worked out this order to rejoin so as to prevent me from attending the committee? It wouldn't surprise me in Griffiths. But since I've never set eyes on Lord Stranraer, I cannot form any opinion of him at all." "To be sure, it was a foolish question. But I hope you'll see him on Sunday. I mean to come back on Friday, post down to Torbay on Saturday, and there we're sure to find some vessel belonging to the squadron that'll carry us out, perhaps by Sunday. They always put into Torbay, you know. Until Friday, then. And God and St. Patrick go with you." There are few more versatile saints than Patrick, and he managed the parliamentary business and the return journey supremely well until the very last lap, when one of the horses lost a shoe just outside Truggett's Hatch, a village that would have been in clear sight of Woolcombe had a hill not stood between them. There they waited at the King's Head and Eight Bells, and while the smith was blowing up his forge, Jack sat in the bar where he called for a pot of ale.
"Well, squire,"
said the landlord, setting it down and wiping the table,
"might I be so bold?"
He knew Jack well. He had a sister married to a commoner on Simmons Lee. He was by only one remove an interested party. Yet he hesitated until he saw Captain Aubrey's beaming face emerge from the tankard with an unmistakable look of satisfied desire.
"So bold as to ask whether everything was to your liking? Mr. Andrews, I couldn't have wished for better. The petition for enclosure was rejected, both for inadequate majority and above all for the Lord of the Manor's direct and firmly stated opposition. So the common is safe, and we can go on in a way we're used to."
The landlord laughed aloud with pleasure. And having dried his hand on his breeches, he held it out.
"Give you joy of your victory, sir. That white black whiskers eye, the lads went through his pheasant coverts the night after that dirty goddamn match, and I dare say that when they hear of this, they'll stir up his deer. Oh, sir, may I tell Tom, my sister Hawkins' son? She'll be so relieved. She was cruel anxious, worn thin and pale, not a scrap of paper to show the place is theirs, though there are Hawkinses in the churchyard by the score." His voice could be heard moving towards the back of the house. "Tom! Tom! Tom! Get in your nag and tell your mum she's safe at last. The captain did the buggers in the eye!"
Tom's nag was no Flying Childers, but running in its own curious, nameless pace, belly very near to the ground, feet twinkling, it did reach Woolhampton well before the Truggetts Hatch Smith had fitted and fastened the shoe, so that when Jack Chaise reached Woolhampton, both sides of the street were lined with cheering villagers, many of whom wished to shake his hand, while others told him they'd already known it would end like this. But most were content with bawling, "Good old Captain Jack!" or "Huzzay! Huzzay! Huzzay!" And when it reached Woolcombe House, there was his entire family, the entire household, arranged on the broad steps like the tableau closing a Drury Lane play with a happy ending. Except that no legitimate theatre would ever have countenanced so squalid a pair of children as Bridget and George. The little girl had inherited her parents' fearless attitude towards horses, and she'd been showing her cousin how to muck out the stable in which the splendid borrowed team spent what time they could spare from carrying Mrs. Matchlin about the countryside. Having kissed the women all round, Jack shook Bondon's bandaged hand, and in a low voice, fit for one so battered, he said, "Well, Bondon, I hope I see you tolerably comfortable. I scarcely thought to find you on your feet so soon after that cruel, foul play." "Which the captain says he trusts you pretty well," said Killick, in a tone that he judged suitable for one so recently comatose. "And no pain." With so much notice, Bondon hung his head and muttered something that Killick translated as, "He says the other son, the other party, copped it worse and is despaired of." They all moved into the hall, and from the hall to the front morning room, where Padine detached the children and led them away towards the pump. Yet even so, Jack's account of his triumph in London was not as open and candid as it would have been with fewer people present. Nor was Sophie's production of the orders to rejoin his ship, which came after you'd left, as she put it, blushing as she did so. Yet, bridled as his words were obliged to be, Jack spoke pretty freely and with growing relish. The orders he dismissed with, "Yes, my dear, I heard about them. I shall post down to Torbay with Stephen tomorrow, if he can manage it, or the day after." "Never mind about posting," said Diana. "I'll drive you down in Chumley's machine. And if General Hart is as good as his word, with his extra pair, I shall drive you down in a coach and six. There's glory for you. I've always wanted to drive a coach and six on an English turnpike." "Have you not driven one before?" cried Sophie in alarm. "Certainly I have, but in India. And once or twice in Ireland, Ned Taft's machine," she added, nodding to Stephen. "We should be very happy," said Jack, bowing. "But now, let me tell you about the committee. First, as you know, Captain Griffiths is a newcomer in these parts. He has no great acquaintance in the neighbourhood. He doesn't know the connections between the older families, all the long-standing friendships, intermarriages and so on. And both he and the parliamentary lawyer he employed were unaware of the fact that Harry Turnbull is my cousin. Indeed, my cousin twice over since he married Lucy Brett. And then he's not a member of any decent club, and he don't know the importance of that connection either." Both Jack and Stephen were members of the Royal Society Club, which did their heads great credit, but they were also members of Blacks, which spoke well for their power of discernment. For although the place wasn't quite so learned, it was somehow more companionable, and incidentally much more to the point in the worldly line. I met Frank Crawshay in the coffee room, the member for Westport. He said he was sitting on the committee. I gather the members had been chosen for their propensity to vote blindfold for the ministry, and it was known that I had abstained when the naval estimates came up. A black mark. And he let me know in a very tactful and what you might call alluvial fashion that his boy was down for election and he should be very grateful for my name in the candidates book. And he told me that there were some other blackses on the committee as well as Cousin Harry. Just as well, thought I, for Harry was in a horrid rage, having lost more money than he cared for to Colonel Whaley, was barely civil, wouldn't lend me a shirt, should be damned if he'd lend me a shirt, scarcely had a shirt to his name, barely a single shirt to his back. You know how cross Harry Turnbull can be. He must have fought more often than any man in the country. A very dangerous shot and very apt to take offence. So, when I walked into the committee room and saw him still looking furious and contrary and bloody-minded, I felt quite uneasy. And those smiles from Crawshay and two other blackses comforted me a little. I didn't really have much hope until the lawyer started proceedings. His low, soapy tone didn't suit Harry, who kept telling him to speak up, to speak like a Christian, for God's sake, and not mumble. When he was young, people never mumbled, he said. You could hear every word. If anyone had mumbled, he would have been kicked out of the room. Then came the petition itself. It was handed to the chairman, Harry, of course, and he began to read out the names of the petitioners and their station. Griffiths, some of his friends, some of the richer farmers. Then he cried, "But where's the parson? Where's the patron?" "The rector has been travelling for his health these last 5 years, sir. He's said to be in Madeira now, but he doesn't answer letters. And the curate cannot speak in his name." "Well, where's the patron of the living? And where's the lord of the manor, the same person, I suppose? Why is his name not here?" Griffiths went red and muttered something to his lawyer. I stood up and said, "I'm the patron of the living, sir, and the lord of the manor. My name is not there because I'm very strongly opposed to the enclosure and to the petition." Harry glared about him, scribbled sums on a piece of paper, and then said to Griffiths, "God's my life, sir, you have the effrontery to present this with just the barest majority by value, when you know perfectly well that three-quarters or four-fifths is the usual figure. And to make things worse, far, far worse, you do so against the will of the lord of the manor, your natural superior. I've never heard of such a thing. I wonder at it, sir, I wonder at it." All this time, Killick and Mnason the butler had been standing outside the door. Their mutual hostility had kept them away from it to begin with, but intense curiosity, and the useful formula "we might either of us be sent for," had brought them to a truce, and their ears were very close to the wood at this very point, when Mrs. Pierce thrust indignantly between them and burst into the room. "Ma'am," she cried, holding up a noble fish, "I couldn't get the men to hear. I couldn't send a maid, and I have to know this directly minute. If I'm to cook this here for dinner, it must go on at once, at once." "Which it came a quarter of an hour ago by the chiming clock. £26 4 ounces without a lie." They gazed upon it with admiration. A silvery, quivering, fresh, clean-run salmon. And on its side it bore a card. "For our captain, with love from all at the Aubrey Arms." That night, which should have been equally triumphant, was not. Misunderstanding, mistiming, and mere weariness played their not uncommon part. And for once, Jack Aubrey got up in a bad temper of mind. He cut his chin while he was shaving, and when he came back into the bedroom, he heard Sophie, her head muffled under her shift, uttering a discontented remark, whose beginning he hadn't heard, but which, as her head emerged, finished with, "That Mrs. Oakes." Jack checked his immediate answer. But having tied his neckcloth, he said, "You often say that, Mrs. Oakes, in a tone that makes me think you imagine something improper about our having been shipmates. Even if I had been Heliogabalus or Colonel Chartres, there couldn't possibly have been anything improper. She came aboard without my knowledge, under the protection of one of my midshipmen. I at once insisted upon their being married. I even gave a piece of that crimson silk I bought you in Java for her to be married in. I may have been something of a rake when I was young, but I give you my sacred word that I have never played the fool at sea, and I should never, never, at any time, look at the wife of one of my officers. So I beg we may hear no more of that Mrs. Oakes." Sophie blushed as crimson as her Java silk, hung her head, and made no reply. The extreme awkwardness being resolved by the breakfast gong beaten in a frenzy by George and Bridget, still in their nightshirts. Diana, late for most things, was prompt for this. Having breakfasted by candlelight, they made an early start in the half-day, the stars still to be seen due west with Venus declining. "Let go," called Diana from the box, and the coach rolled smoothly away, followed by a chaise carrying Killigan Bondon, who was in no state to travel outside a coach, and leaving such a melancholy group waving on the steps, some indeed in tears. The men had drawn lots to decide which should sit next to Diana for the first stage. It had fallen on Dundas. So Stephen and Jack were inside, with the head groom and the boy up behind. Jack remained silent for a while. He and Sophie disagreed fairly often, though perhaps less than most married people, but never had they done so on parting. It was true that this wasn't much of a parting. Leave from the Brest blockade was reasonably frequent in letters passed to and fro. And it was true that Sophie's attitude towards Clarissa Oakes, a guest, after all, had irritated him extremely. All the more so since he had at one time been strongly tempted to lead Clarissa far astray. He was not a man to whom chastity came easy, and he'd had to impose a most rigorous self-command. But he was sorry he'd spoken. Eventually, he said, "Old Harding's of opinion that the salmon had been ordered by Griffiths, and that it came by coach, being left at the Arms, according to village gossip he'd ordered dinner for a score, for none of our streams ever yielded a fish like that. But I do hope our people aren't coming it too high. The young fellows took some of his deer last night, and his keepers were out in force. I heard shots." "The devil you did," cried Jack. And he would have gone on, but that the coach was now in the village street and that many of the overexcited youths were still about. They started cheering and waving, and the horses began to caper. Fortunately, General Hart had thought better of his promise to provide an extra pair, but even so, Dundas was tempted to take the reins. The determined expression on Diana's face, most vividly alive, and the language in which she recalled the horses to their duty, checked him, however. And presently the team were steadily climbing the hill before Maiden Oscott. "I wish they may not be coming it too high," said Jack. "Stealing deer may be fun, but it's a very grave matter indeed when you come before a court, above all if you are disguised in any way. And Billy Isles, who ran by the coach just now, had a sort of skirt on and the remains of black round his face. Or, above all, if you were armed. You heard shots. That Griffiths is a rancorous sort of cove. Weak. You should have seen him quail before Harry Turnbull. And cruel. And there was that damned unlucky omen." He jerked his head towards the chaise with poor Bondon in it, and sank into an uneasy train of thought while the coach climbed up and up, the horses well into their collars, warming now. Near the top, he looked back for a last sight of Woolcombe, spread out far, far below, with both broad commons, the villages, and the great mere, silver now with the coming day. "Oh, my God!" he cried, for there, over beyond Woolcombe, stacks were ablaze, a great pall of smoke drifting westwards, the bottom lit red. He let down the glass, leant out, and called to the groom behind, "Is that Hordesworth Rickyard, John?"
"It is on Captain Griffith's land, sir. The new PC took in to round the home farm."
They were over the crest. Nothing could be seen on the far side of the hill. Indeed, they were well over and on the flat stretch of road before the much steeper descent to Maiden Oscott and the stream. And both Stephen and Jack heard Diana encourage the horses. There was a dogcart ahead, drawn by a likely-looking chestnut mare and driven by a young man with a girl beside him.
"Give him a halloo to pull over, will you, Dundas?" said Diana, and he let out a fine nautical roar.
The girl nudged the young man, who looked round, flicked the mare with his whip, and crouched forward, urging her on. Gradually the coach overhauled the dog-cart. Diana, tense and concentrated in complete control of the horses. But there was a left-handed corner ahead and not 200 yards to go.
"Pull over, sir! Pull over directly!"
called Dundas with all the authority of 20 years at sea. His vehemence, coupled with the pleas of the pale-faced girl, induced the young man to rein in with his off-wheel on the grassy verge. The coach swept by, followed by a look of pure hatred.
"There was a good 2 foot to spare, so there was,"
said Stephen, relaxing.
"It's very well," said Jack, "very well. But I dread the Oscott Bridge. Does Diana know it, Stephen?"
"Sure, she's been driving about the countryside day and night. It's her liveliest joy. But tell me, where is young Philip?"
"Oh, he stayed at home to worship Mrs. Oakes. Didn't you remark his moon-struck gaze?" "Now, of course, you were sitting next to him. Still, you might have seen him pick up a napkin and press it to his lips. But this bridge is a most damnably awkward one. You come down a wicked steep hill in the middle of the village, and there, right in front of you, there's the bridge. Hard on your left, a blind corner at an angle of 90 or even 100 degrees before you're aware of it. You have to turn terribly sharp. A damned narrow bridge with a low stone wall on either side, and unless you judge it just so, you hit the corner and you're in the river 20 feet below. Deep water, with the coach on top. Don't you think you might mention it to her?"
"I do not. She's a very fine whip, you know."
"Then perhaps I should," said Jack.
Stephen bowed, and after a moment Jack lowered the glass again, leant out, and in a conciliating tone he called, "Cars! Oh, cars!" The coach slowed perceptibly.
"What now?" replied Diana. "It's only that I thought, being a native, as it were, that I thought perhaps I should tell you about the very dangerous bridge at Maiden Oscott, but perhaps you know it."
"Jack Aubrey," she said, "if you don't like the way I drive this coach, take the bloody reins yourself and be damned to you."
"Not at all, not at all," cried Jack. "It was only that I thought..."
The horses resumed their fine round pace. Jack sank back.
"Perhaps I vexed her," he said. "That I spoke both meek and civil."
"Perhaps you have," said Stephen. The downward slope grew steeper, then even steeper. The first houses appeared, and very soon they were in the street itself. Dundas hallooing to clear dogs, cats, asses, and children out of the way, and the horses going rather faster than Diana would have allowed at another time. She had the tension of the reins just so. Her hands were in close touch with the horses' mouths, and her keen gaze was fixed on the left-hand leading corner of the wall that crossed the bridge, a wall scarred by innumerable vehicles in the last 400 years. With a last glance down at the hub of her near forewheel, she changed the pressure on the reins, clucked to the leaders, and swung the coach square onto the narrow bridge, avoiding the stone by half an inch, and trotting superbly across to the other side. where the maiden Oscott Road, having risen again and fallen again, joined the Exeter Turnpike, she pulled up at a famous coaching inn by a delightful stream, and while the others held the horses' heads, she climbed nimbly down. Jack gave her a hand from the lower step and said, "I do ask your pardon, Diana." "Never mind it, Jack," she said with a brilliant smile. She was in excellent looks with the fine fresh air and the excitement. "I've been frightened too aboard your ships. Now be a good fellow and call for rum, coffee, toast and perhaps bacon and eggs if they have nothing better. Lord, I could do with a decent second breakfast. But for the moment I must retire." Jack had given orders for the horses to be watered and walked up and down before their moderate bite, and he was rejoining his friends in front of the inn when he heard his name called. It was William Dolby, followed by Harry Lovage, both old friends. Lovage was called Old Lechery, crossing the road from the stream, both carrying fishing rods, and both looking thoroughly happy. Indeed, it was a delightful morning, a delightful scene, the water flowing in its smooth green banks, the scent of a late aftermath drifting across, and the air full of swallows. "Look what we've caught," cried Dolby, opening his bag. "Such trout you might dream of the glorious day." "My best are still larger," said Lovage. "You must breakfast with us. The two fishes ain't in it, nor the five loaves. Dick," this to a waiter, "leave us all in the dolphin parlour, would you?" They moved slowly across the forecourt, admiring the fish, talking of claret and mallard and the mayfly hatch, and Lovage said, "There'll be plenty of a supper, and if there ain't, we shall make up on the evening rise. Fish suppers make a man skip like a flea. We have Nellie Clapham with us, and her young sister Sue. Such a cheerful, jolly..." He stopped abruptly, looking appalled, for there in the porch, pausing to join them, was Diana, very clearly not a lady of pleasure. They broke off to receive her, introductions, and Stephen said, "My dear, these gentlemen have invited us to breakfast with them on some of the noblest trout that ever yet were seen. But it may well be that you're tired after your drive and would as soon sit quietly with a little thin gruel and perhaps a very small cup of chocolate. I cannot recommend cream or sugar." "Never in life. I should be very happy to breakfast on these gentlemen's catch in the company of their friends whom I met on the stairs. They seemed good-natured young ladies and they were singing, oh, so sweetly." It was a successful breakfast. The young ladies, finding that Diana gave herself neither airs nor graces, soon got over their shyness. The trout were excellent, the conversation free and cheerful, and at the end Nellie, having run upstairs for a small guitar, gave them a song, cheered to the echo by many people in other parts of the inn, and by a beaming, barely recognisable killick at the window, while Dolby begged Diana and her party to stay to dinner. There'd be a famous hare soup and black cock from Somerset. "Thank you, sir," she replied. "I would with all my heart, but I've promised to deliver these gentlemen to Torbay, and deliver them I shall, in spite of a certain timidity on the part of some of the crew."